there will be people who will always resent him for it, and their hearts are closed to anything that he has to say.
A statement from the captain of the Exxon Valdez. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 9th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Iditarod mushers work to get the most from their dog teams early in the race.
You have this big magic pot of energy that you're just trying to put together and make into this, you know, wonderful piece of art.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Parents that read to their children foster early learning and educational development for children and youth. Information at aasb.org.
20 years after the Exxon Valdez disaster, the ship's captain is apologizing to Alaska in a new book called The Spill, Personal Stories from the Exxon Valdez Disaster. Joe Hazelwood says, "I would like to offer an apology, a very heartfelt apology, to the people of Alaska." On March 24, 1989, the Exxon Valdez went aground in Prince William Sound, spilling at least 11 million gallons of oil. Sharon Bushell talked to Joe Hazelwood last year for the book. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Lori.
Sharon, how was it that you were able to talk with Joe Hazelwood?
Well, I think he wanted to say another word about it. And that was his main objective, was to offer an apology.
And Sharon, besides apologizing, what else did he say?
I have to tell you that I did not ask him the hard questions. In an effort to gather the story, I didn't think that it was going to be beneficial to ask confrontational questions. So he told the parts of it that he felt comfortable telling, and the parts that he did not speak to are a matter of public record.
And Sharon, did he acknowledge any responsibility for the spill?
Well, he was the captain of the ship that caused this calamity in Prince William Sound. So in that sense, I think yes.
But did he speak to it directly or not?
Well, it seems to me like it's just implied in the apology and in his willingness to speak to me. I think that he does take responsibility for it, yes.
And did you get a sense of what his life has been like these last two decades?
Mm-hmm. I did. He has a life. He is a very private person. He really is just a down-to-earth, regular guy with a very wry sense of humor. He works in a law office. He races boats. I honestly think Joe's one of the good guys. He was involved in a hideous accident, no doubt, and he lives with that every day of his life. But he has gone on to have a life and have some joy, but I think it's a huge weight.
Sharon, how do you think Joe Hazelwood's apology will be received by the people most affected by the spill?
I think that people have been waiting for this for a long time, and I think that they will be gracious. I think that there will be people who will always resent him for it, and their hearts are closed to anything that he has to say.
Sharon Bushell talked with Exxon Valdez Captain Joe Hazelwood for the book The Spill, Personal Stories from the Exxon Valdez Disaster. It's published by Epicenter Press for the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. A giant rosary made of gillnet floats, a seafoam green dress that looks like it's been splotched with oil, and a pirate flag adorned with a middle finger and the word Exxon down the side. These pieces and more are part of an exhibit commemorating the 20th anniversary of the spill, which opened at a gallery in Homer Friday. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
The exhibit is titled simply Spill, and it's curated by Bunnell director Asia Freeman, who grew up in a fishing family and so knows all too well the pain and devastation wrought by the Exxon Valdez.
What it has made me realize is how much emotion remains unsettled within Alaskans due to the conditions that allowed the spill to happen and the way that the political process worked since that time.
Spill sprang out of a conversation that Freeman had with Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council Outreach Coordinator Linda Robinson, herself an artist. Freeman says after Robinson mentioned that many Alaskan artists might want to do something to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the spill this month, she got busy soliciting works. The final exhibit features 30 artists from around the state working in a variety of media.
In effect, we remain really angry and emotional about it. And yet, as artists have within us this incredible opposing dynamic force, which is to wrestle beauty and ultimately optimistic statements from these profoundly traumatized sort of emotions.
Many of the artists included in Spill use natural elements in their pieces. This serves as a reminder of how the oil spill harmed the environment and remains among the worst man-made disasters in our country's history. Homer artist Rika Mao used mussel shells to fashion what she calls a giant teardrop for her piece. 20 years later, tears are still falling.
They are jewels. They're also earthbound and represent place and the fact that they are filterers, water filterers, and that's how they sustain themselves, is filtering water for food. So they're the frontline casualties of marine travesties.
Mao estimates she put about 150 hours into her piece. She says that gave her a lot of time to think and reflect on the impacts that the spill had not only on the environment, but people as well. And she says so many of the pieces in Spill evoke similar feelings in her that it's really worth checking out.
I am just honored to be included in this show because this show, when you read the artist statements, the heartfelt emotions that are coming out of these spectacular pieces. It just feels good to be in and amongst other extremely passionate and artistically articulate artists.
Spill is showing all this month at the Bunnell Street at the same time as the Pratt Museum Science and Art Show Reflections of a Spill opening later this month. It then becomes a traveling exhibit with stops scheduled for Kodiak, Kenai and Soldotna, Cordova, and Anchorage. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Sebastian Schnula, fresh off a victory in last month's Yukon Quest, led the way out of the Rainy Pass Iditarod checkpoint at 3:35 this afternoon. He was followed closely by Paul Gebhardt, Rick Swenson, and Aaron Burmeister from Nenana. Burmeister says he's running the best dog team he's ever had.
So I've spent about the last 10 years building this team to where they are right now. I've been very conservative in races this season, saving them for Iditarod. I feel they're very strong and just right where I want them to be today.
Two-time defending champ Lance Mackey was the first musher into Rainy Pass this morning. Mackey is optimistic about his chances for a third straight win.
Absolutely. That remains to be seen, but this team is very capable of it, no doubt about that. And we've proved that we're capable, so yeah, absolutely. I'm ready for the challenge.
Another musher who thinks his team can be first to Nome is Hugh Neff, who lives on Annie Lake near Whitehorse, Yukon. Neff is currently running in fifth place. He has never finished higher than 19th in the Iditarod, but he says this is his year.
You always wonder if you can hang out with the big boys. And this year I know that, I mean, I see the way people look at me, and I see the way, you know, guys like Hans Gatter or whoever look at my dog team, and I know that I have a nice-looking team, and for me it's just about taking care of them and controlling my competitive juices until the right moment, and just waiting until we get to that spot where I think it's time to shift it into another gear.
Neff calls himself a hyper guy who has a tendency to let his arrogance get the best of him. Neff says his dogs have an incredible amount of energy, and he says it's his job to turn that into a team that can power up hills and speed across flats.
being a musher, it's more than being an athlete. It's more like being a magician. And you have this big, magic pot of energy that you're just trying to put together and make into this, wonderful piece of art.
And Neff says the mental game of the Iditarod, figuring out when to rest and run and when to make a move, is just as important as the physical condition of the mushers and their dogs. The only other musher who's left the Rainy Pass checkpoint is Melissa Owens of Nome. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a conversation about the future of the Arctic.
It's much easier to create models that will say sea ice will decline than to say where it will decline and exactly when.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
Hundreds of environmentalists and advocates for the oceans are gathered in Washington, D.C. this week at the Blue Vision Ocean Summit, a conference focused on the future health of the world's seas. Some of the conversation has centered around the Arctic and sea ice melt. At a panel discussion today, an expert on the Arctic environment warned that it's time to come up with management plans addressing rapid and dramatic melt. Dr. Stephanie Furman is a professor at Columbia University and has done research in the Arctic for nearly 30 years. Furman says it's time to think about how to preserve quality of life in the Arctic.
Just as, when somebody gets a really grim health diagnosis, you try to maintain the quality of life as best you can, and you also try to figure out what you can do to sustain, the functions that are working well. And I think that's one of the ways that we need to think about the Arctic. The long-range prospect in terms of sea ice is quite grim, but there are several decades that we think where we'll be in this transition state.
Furman says she and her colleagues were unnerved in 2007 when the Arctic sea ice hit a record low, more than 20% lower than the previous September. The melt is happening faster than most models predicted. Furman is also looking at ice age because older, thicker ice is harder to melt and serves as a platform for marine life like polar bears and seals. Furman says the oldest ice is not found around Alaska, but north of the Canadian archipelago and above Greenland. She says those areas are expected to maintain ice the longest.
So when you think of animals taking refuge, this is where it's likely to be. And so this is a very special place because over the coming decades, as the ice is melting throughout the rest of the Arctic, this area here could retain the last vestiges of Arctic sea ice habitat for a while. How long? We're not exactly sure. It's much easier to create models that will say sea ice will decline than to say where it will decline and exactly when.
Furman says current models predict Arctic sea ice will be gone by the end of the century. Many agencies and entrepreneurs are looking at the opening Arctic as an opportunity for shipping and resource development. Coast Guard Senior Ocean Policy Advisor Dr. John Oliver says they're preparing for added security missions and response plans for possible shipping disasters.
I'll just go with the three S's. Security, which is maritime security, domain awareness and maritime security, safety, including maritime safety and environmental safety, and then the stewardship responsibility.
The Obama administration has yet to give a blueprint for its Arctic goals. The chairwoman of the White House Council on Environmental Quality spoke at the Ocean Conference today and said the administration is very concerned about sea level rise and the effects of climate change on oceans. But Sutley says they're still learning about the complex issues of the Arctic.
I think this is the point at which I say, hey, we've been here for 6 weeks. I mean, I think we recognize that the Arctic, poses some very significant challenges environmentally, from a governance perspective, trying to understand the impact of climate change, of energy development, of the peoples who live in the Arctic.
Sutley says the Obama administration does believe the Arctic needs care, management, and protection. This week's Blue Vision Ocean Summit is being sponsored by a host of environmental groups, including Oceana and the Pew Environmental Group, and is being attended by fisheries advocates, ocean explorers, and scientists, as well as environmentalists from around the country. Energy grants recently okayed by the legislature will advance about 15 Southeast Alaska power projects. They include power lines, hydro plants, and heat pumps from Metlakatla to Yakutat. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The grants will help develop several new hydropower projects. None get enough money to complete, but several will be helped along with design, construction, or both. Sitka's Tackett's Lake Hydro, for example, gets about $500,000 for a feasibility study. The full project is listed at costing more than $200 million. Ketchikan's Whitman Lake project gets $1.3 million towards an estimated $18 million total, and Petersburg's Ruth Lake Hydro gets $160,000 for reconnaissance work. Heidelberg's Reynolds Creek project also gets money. Haines Representative Bill Thomas, who represents most of Prince of Wales Island, says it will help more than Heidelberg.
We've put $2 million to build a new hydro to try to get all of Prince of Wales on hydro. They are already, but they still go to diesel sometime. I think this is going to put them pretty close to be able to stay on hydro year-round. And this is also going to complement the new fish processing facility going to be built in Craig.
Another $3.75 million grant extends the island's power grid north to Naugatie and Kaufman Cove. Other grants will help link power plants elsewhere in Southeast. There's almost $3 million for design of a Cape Petersburg intertie that would use power generated at Tai Lake, which is already being linked to Ketchikan Swan Lake hydro plant. Another project, which got about $800,000, would advance a power line connecting Ketchikan to Metlakatla on nearby Annette Island. Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson says it's another part of connecting Southern Southeast's power sources.
Metlakatla has resources over there. They have a dam. They're working on possibly getting a couple more permitted to get that power into the grid. So a major portion of the Southeast Intertie System is to connect Ketchikan with Metlakatla.
Not all proposed projects were funded. Hoona was not awarded anything for a power line connecting it to the Greens Creek Mine and ultimately to Juneau's power system. And a tidal power study involving Wrangell, Angoon, and Gustavus was also left off the list. But Johansson says the grants that were awarded will help make progress towards the ultimate goal of getting most Southeast communities off expensive diesel generators.
Within 5 years, you could have Metlakatla pushing power all the way up to Cake and vice versa. And it's just incremental steps of marching along towards the goal of hooking up as many communities to as many dams as we can to have energy independence in Southeast.
Several of the grants support less traditional energy sources. Juneau got about $2 million for airport and swimming pool projects that draw heat out of the ground. Haines was awarded about $250,000 for biomass heating at a low-income housing project, and Yakutat will see a similar amount for biomass gasification. The nearly $17 million in Southeast grants comes from a $100 million renewable energy fund created last year by the legislature. The grants were announced last month after screening by the Alaska Energy Authority and approval by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Another $25 to $50 million will be made available this year. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The House Finance Committee is getting a state operating budget ready for floor debate and a vote by the end of the week. Today, members open consideration of amendments from the results of subcommittee reports and 2 days of public testimony. Among the changes today, members providing full funding for power cost equalization program. However, Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra questioned the level of funding. During last year's special session, the legislature authorized assisting rural residents with rates of up to $1 a kilowatt hour. But he says that was only a one-year appropriation. He questioned whether this extension would cover at the dollar rate or would return to the old 52 cents a kilowatt hour rate. Co-chairman Mike Hawker told Guerra the most recent policy call would prevail, including any increases that pass this session.
That partial year of the increased funding rate that was passed in a policy bill last year stands and is funded with this appropriation.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I understand what you said. So the policy call this year, unless we change it, is it's up to 52 cents, right? So unless we change that, there's no coverage above 52 cents. Is that correct?
Representative Osterman.
That is correct, and it sunsets. There is legislation in both the Senate and the House to fix that, to take that sunset off. And assuming that we do take it off, then this covers it.
Another amendment restored funds vetoed by the governor in last year's Marine Highway System budget. NOM's Richard Foster sponsored the amendment. His chief of staff, Larry LeBole, explained that the step would add more than $6 million to the Marine Highway's operations needs. It would also capitalize the Marine Highway Stabilization Fund and reappropriate more than $9 million in money for fuel expenses.
With this combination of amendments, we feel that it will make the Marine Highway capable of carrying out their schedule as they have projected it through September of 2009. And it will also capitalize the fund to a level where they should have adequate cash flow through this next fiscal year.
The panel plans to meet tomorrow and Wednesday, if necessary, with other issues. The target is getting a finished budget on the House floor by Thursday.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the new AT&T, your world delivered, and by the Alaska State Elks Lodges, providing children the opportunity to attend summer camp and other age-appropriate activities. Information at alaskastateelks.org.
A federal appeals court panel has vacated the opinion it issued last year that stopped Shell Oil's exploratory drilling plans for the Beaufort Sea. But both sides in the case have been left wondering what it means. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on Friday gave no indication whether a change in the November 20th ruling would mean exploration drilling will be allowed or whether the ruling will be replaced with a similar decision. The court in November concluded that the Federal Minerals Management Service improperly granted Shell permission for exploratory drilling in the Beaufort Sea. Judges ordered the MMS to reconsider how cumulative impacts would affect wildlife and subsistence hunting and fishing. MMS officials disputed the ruling and said the agency had extensively analyzed potential impacts to wildlife. Shell asked for a review by the entire Ninth Circuit Court. The company postponed exploration for 2009 on leases it holds in the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea off Alaska's northwest coast. It's not known when the revised ruling will be out. An infantryman from Fort Richardson was killed in Afghanistan Sunday morning. 27-year-old Private First Class Patrick A. DeVoe II from Auburn, New York, died from injuries sustained when an improvised bomb hit the vehicle he was driving while on a mounted patrol. DeVoe was assigned to the 1st Squadron, 40th Cavalry Regiment, 4th Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division. DeVoe joined the Army in January 2008 and arrived in the 140th Cavalry Regiment in July 2008. Next of kin have been notified. The Senate Transportation Committee has signed off on a bill that would allow the operation of low-speed electric vehicles in some Alaskan communities. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
As written, the substitute bill would limit the use of low-speed vehicles to communities of less than 25,000 people and which are not connected by highway to Anchorage or Fairbanks. Low-speed vehicles are usually electric-powered and travel at up to 25 miles per hour. They are legal in Alaska now, but only on roads with posted speed limits of 35 miles per hour or less. The Division of Motor Vehicles has registered 19 low-speed vehicles in Alaska, 10 of which are in Petersburg. Several other vehicles are in Sitka and Kodiak, all island communities with highways of 45 miles per hour. The new language won cautious approval in Monday's hearing from the State Department of Transportation, which had opposed SB 59 in its first hearing last month. Roger Healy is the DOT's chief engineer.
The department is in support of the scope and intent of this bill. We as the department are always concerned with vehicles traveling at different speeds. However, we recognize that our right-of-ways have to accommodate a lot of uses, and this is one we're willing to support.
Public opinion at the hearing was mixed. Petersburg resident Jerry Herbrinson has an electric car dealership. He urged the committee to be forward-thinking about the use of cleaner vehicles.
I recommend that the state of Alaska make a positive statement in support of low-speed vehicles and energy conservation. by allowing the use in all communities of 25,000 or less, unless that community chooses to exempt itself.
Sitka resident Megan Pasternak drives a Zen electric car, one of three in the state. She endorsed the cars as a proactive step Alaskans can take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Pasternak tried to allay some concern on the committee that low-speed cars were going to create congestion.
As a low-speed vehicle driver, I am very conscious of the traffic around me and do not impede others who want to go faster than my allowed 25 miles per hour. I do this by waiting to enter a roadway until approaching traffic is far away and by pulling over to the side whenever possible to allow others to pass. I'm sure other low-speed vehicle drivers are just as conscientious.
Pasternak said she believed the lightweight cars were safe and tended to bounce away from collisions rather than absorb impact like a heavier vehicle. She added that her car came equipped to travel at 35 miles per hour but had to be modified to comply with existing state and federal low-speed vehicle laws. Andrew Tomes, the executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society, told the committee that passing the bill signaled Alaska's readiness to participate in changes in the way we travel.
Anything that this body can do to make it possible to be able to use those on Alaskan roads and to be able to allow the consumer to purchase those and to be able to send a message to auto manufacturers and the federal government that the sorts of incentives and laws need to be passed so that these vehicles can be used, I think is just a tremendous step forward.
That step forward was of concern to at least one committee member. The largest single pool of federal and state highway funding comes from the motor vehicle fuels tax. Although only 19 electric cars are on the road today, Fairbanks Senator Joe Pascavan saw trouble if the trend continued to grow.
I believe it's becoming more and more of a problem or an issue anyway as far as vehicles that are not paying their fair share in the sense of the maintenance of the highways. Historically, that's always been through the motor vehicle taxes, both federal and state. And at some point, I would think it would become a significant problem for our highway system in Alaska if we have more vehicles that are not paying motor vehicle taxes. How do we maintain our roadways?
SB 59 will be heard next by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.